Hey everybody, welcome to the Snapcast. I'm Bobby.
I'm Jerry.
And I'm Alex.
All right, so Alex was a little bit late on that because our charisma is off a little today because Alex is calling in. So we're going to test this out and see how it goes, but bear with us just in case we have any kind of like disturbances, things like that. But fingers crossed. We've done our homework. Hopefully everything should work out just fine. Rob is on duty today, so we're missing Rob. And then Chris is on some sort of crazy John Deere lawn equipment journey, pilgrimage, I guess. He's getting some lawn equipment. He wants to start doing landscaping on the side. So hopefully all that's going well for him. All right, so today we're going to be talking news like we always do, and then we're going to be coming back after the break to talk about going rogue, like when you should build a rogue deck, the proper times to do that, you'll see. So let's fire off some news. Well, first, what have you guys been doing this week?
Well, I just got back from Las Vegas Invitational, and I didn't do so hot in the standard. I went 0-2-2 with two draws all because of time, and in the modern portion, I went 3-1, which I was really proud of. And then I followed it up with a modern challenge the next day and 4-0'd that.
Nice.
Hit up on that prize wall.
Heck yeah, Chuck E. Cheese time.
Yeah, Chuck E. Cheese tickets for everyone. And then on Sunday, I did the modern challenge, or not modern challenge, what do we call it? What do they call them now? It's no longer the 5K. It's a modern classic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I went 5-3 in that.
Got nice. Your Chuck E. Cheese tickets?
Yeah, I got some Chuck E. Cheese tickets for that, too.
Yeah, so before we move on, man, tell us about it. Like, what were your impressions of the prize wall?
Prize wall sucks. This is the worst thing you could ever do to Eternal Magic players. I'm not asking for, say, like if I 4-0 a challenge, I'm not asking for $200 or even a full box. But at the same time, when all I got in tickets was half a box of Battle for Bulk, of all the things. Like, there's just nothing in Battle for Zendikar. I couldn't pick up Cons because they were sold out of Cons. I couldn't pick up Origins because they were sold out of Origins. Because I'd rather picked up Cons for Fetches, followed by Origins for Jace. Neither of those were optional, so now I'm digging for Expeditions.
Yeah.
Didn't hit, and didn't get much value out of it. Like, I'd rather them just give me $50, and that would have been the end of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest problems with the new prize wall system is if you're playing a Sunday tournament, it's going to go all day, so at the end, everything's sold out.
Yeah.
Like, what you want may not be available.
Yeah, and I mean, even one step beyond that, like, it puts the power of what the prizes are up to whoever's hosting the tournament, and I mean, really, there's no reason for them to say, hey, we want to save this product for next week, so stick it in the back. You know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden, it's not available in the prize wall. So there's this kind of weird roll of the dice. Now, before you entered in these tournaments, like, was the prize wall set up all day long?
Yeah, the prize wall was set up for the entire weekend. Anytime you got tickets, you could go to the prize wall. Star City Games employee would come up to you, and, you know, they'd do the transaction from there. You give them your physical little cardboard copy of the tickets. They'd go to the prize wall. The other thing that was disappointing about it was the prizes themselves weren't that good. Like, the best prize I saw up there was a box of World Wake, which went for 3,000 tickets, which is 10 tickets would get you a booster pack.
Okay.
So you're paying about $300 essentially to get this booster box, which is okay, but at the same time, the only people who were getting 3,000 tickets were, you know, open and invitational winners. Like, nobody was just getting 3,000 tickets in a weekend.
Wait, so open winners were getting tickets too?
I mean, I'm not even 100% sure if open winners were getting it, but to get 3,000 tickets in a weekend, winners of the challenges, and I'm pretty sure it was the Classic that gave it, the Classic gave away the biggest amount of tickets. But the challenge winners were only getting 360. You're telling me that I got to play about 9 challenges to win 3,000 tickets for your biggest prize when your tickets only last a weekend?
Like, oh, wow. Do they really?
Yeah. They don't translate over. They don't take tickets later.
Oh, okay. So that really puts a damper on it because that immediately in my mind went to, well, that's not horrible, I guess, if you collect tickets over a few weekends, but apparently that's not an option. Man, that's rough. Like,
maybe at some point they'll switch to that, because that seems to be the best option. But at the same time, I don't think they want to do it because they don't want people obtaining store credit that way. I just don't feel that's a great business model for them. However, it is a great way to make the prize wall seem better than what it is.
Well, then counterfeiting comes into an issue too. If you let it go past the weekend, now they've got to keep track of the ticket. What were the tickets physically like? I mean, were they literally like raffle tickets? Or
they were little cardboard pieces that said Las Vegas Invitational, and I'm pretty sure there was a stamp on it somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if they start doing it where you can use them any weekend, then you get into the issue of like, is an employee for this one going to know what the one from the Pacific event 2 months ago looks like? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
this is going to be too hard to keep up with if they're consistent or not. So I can kind of see the argument there, but yeah, that really kills, I mean, any potential of getting the higher end prizes.
If you really want to fix the prize wall, at least in a more reasonable way, offer singles as prizes. They weren't doing that, and I half expected that they wouldn't, but at the same time, I was hoping they would, and they weren't doing it. So that was a little disappointing too.
Yeah, that's a shame. I mean, you've got to imagine that there's something to gain for them from this, obviously, because if you're moving away from cash and making this system, now all of a sudden, like, there's so many more things they have to deal with in a weekend. So in order for it to be worth it, they've got to be making more money this way.
I don't think it's that they're making more money. I think it's that they're not losing more money.
Right. And they get to choose which product they can push. And yeah.
Like, I had received a stat from one of the judges that they had to have 184 players to break even on the old 5Ks.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they just wouldn't hit that, and they'd end up losing money, and that happened a lot with Legacy, which is why Star City's cutting on it.
Wow, okay.
But they still had 130-something people show up for Legacy, so maybe with them cutting Legacy, the prices go down, people pick them back up, Legacy picks back up, maybe at that point, they bring it back. I know I kind of went off on a tangent there with Legacy off the prize wall, but at the same time, it goes hand in hand, because who wants this prize wall crap when you are an eternal player?
Right.
You have the most expensive things to play.
Yeah, because I mean, I think like standard players, and if you're just getting in the game, you're just playing standard, prize wall is probably fine. I mean, for the most part, it's still lame, but there's still plenty of things you'd be excited to pick up. You'd be excited to get a half box or a box or what have you. So it doesn't hit nearly as hard there as people who've been playing a long time are like, we don't want this stuff. Like, so now you've got to choose, do I just not play in this event? Are the prizes worth it? I mean, it's still fun to play Magic, and I think that's where they're going to get us, is that we're still going to show up. We're still going to play, but man, that's rough. But Alex,
most times, I mean, you're there anyway. You're there for the weekend. You might as well play on a Sunday, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true, because it is just the Sunday events for now. So hopefully we never see this break into big-time events, Open itself. I don't think we ever would.
I think they'll leave it out of the Opens because of the amount it costs of entry, and that's the big event. I think they're going to keep Opens and Invitationals in the money.
Yeah.
I think it would be an uprising if they didn't.
I would honestly stop playing Star City tournaments at that point, and I would just be looking forward to Wizards of the Coast sanctioned tournaments at that point.
Yeah, and so far, it's a lot of negativity about the prize wall, so, I mean, it'll be interesting to watch and see what they do. I think that they're in a position now where they have to try to shift it somehow. They're going to have to revitalize it, try again somehow, you know what I mean? Maybe better prizes, better payout, I don't know what, but it'll be cool to see what they come up with after this, because hopefully they'll fix this up to make it at least not feel quite as bad. But, all right, so let's break out of that. Oh, Alex, what did you do this week?
this week, not a whole lot. 2 weekends ago, I played a 5K up in Chicago.
Yeah, how are you feeling about the new meta out there?
It was a 7-rounder, 5 rounds in a row I played Abzan. So, yeah. I was on Black-White Tokens, which isn't the best matchup. I think it's actually in Abzan's favor for the most part for that one.
Yeah, so I mean, what are you going to do? You played another tournament too recently, right?
Nope, that's it.
Okay. Man, see, we got to get you on the cast more so we can stay in touch.
Right.
But, all right, cool. Then let's get out of that and let's talk some news. We've had tons of spoilers between last episode and this episode. I made a note on it last time about the huge drop, the leak, really. It wasn't even spoilers of all the mythics and the expeditions and everything. So, I mean, if there's any of those you guys want to talk about before we move on.
Not so much on the spoilers, but the leak themselves. The last time a leak of somewhat similar level when New Phyrexia happened, players got banned.
Yeah.
Not just any player, but the current world champion and a friend of his, Guillaume Wafotapa and Guillaume Mantignon, both received extended penalties. I'm not 100% sure how long they were. I just know that they were longer than a year and they were out of Magic for some time. So I wouldn't be surprised if at some point we see a name get dropped for banning and it gets hit up for news, because that was pretty big news, you know.
Yeah.
Two big name players had a had a hold of this entire list of new cards, and the reason they got banned was the thought of that they were cheating because they knew cards ahead of time.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can't prove it, but Wizards said, nah, you leaked our information. This is how we can punish you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. Like, wherever these came from, like, I think most players went through the same thing of the excitement of, holy cow, we can see all these spoilers. And then all of a sudden you realize, like, man, like, that was, those were the hammers they were going to drop. You know what I mean? One of those was probably going to be the Christmas Day spoiler. These were going to be the big spoilers they're hitting over the next few weeks to build anticipation. And now instead they've all just been released, and that's that. So I'm sure wherever this came from, there's going to be some repercussions.
Yeah, because right now we're all looking at it, and we can all see clearly the power level of the new Nissa and the Kozilek's Return. Both of those cards are through the roof, and we're going to have a lot more time than we were probably going to be granted to figure this out for the new Standard and any other Eternal formats.
Yeah, it's a huge leg up for pro players, because, I mean, now they've... I mean, now, obviously, there's still a lot of the set that needs to be spoiled, so I don't want to get too crazy, but they do have a lot more time now to start brewing and working on it, and granted, that's a given for any Magic player that's aware of the spoilers, but pros are the ones that really are going to abuse that information and get a leg up off of it. But yeah, did you guys, I mean, any of the cards you saw, though, anything stick out? I know you mentioned Nissa already.
The new Nissa, for me. I absolutely think this new Nissa is a combination of the original Johnny Goldmane and the original Elspeth Knight Errant. You put them together and you get the best of both halves in every possible way. You have that plus one that just generates a token every turn. In Elspeth, it was a... granted, Elspeth was a 1-1. You're a 3-drop now instead of a 4-drop, and you get a 0-1. The minus two is, if I'm not mistaken, the same word for word that a Johnny Goldmane had, where Johnny Goldmane put a plus one counter on everything, just like this Nissa does. And the ultimate on this one is better than both of them. The Elspeth one can be argued that it could be better, but I think a Sphinx's Revelation is just better.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about this, mostly seeing the Sphinx's Rev as the ultimate. I was like, all right, Bant control. Where does this fit in?
Yeah, I was obviously kind of taken aback on the Sphinx's Rev on a green card. Okay, sure.
Now, green stealing all blue is good stuff. It's been happening for years now. I'm sick of it, but whatever. I'll just embrace green as the new blue. But no, I mean, I definitely think, like, whenever you see a 3-mana walker, like, right away that puts it in contention for seeing play. I mean, that's awesome. Something for 3-mana is going to stick around and drop out stuff. The O1s are sort of that pseudo-protection for Nissa. I mean, unless if you're dealing with Flyers or Trample, you're good to go.
And that was the same issue that Elspeth Knight Errant had.
Yeah, exactly.
They weren't dealing with Flyers and Tramplers then, and Elspeth was arguably one of the best Planeswalkers ever printed behind Jace the Mind Sculptor.
Yeah, and then, I mean, like, we were talking about modern elves and standard elves seeing play with Nissa, where being able to drop it, put a plus one counter on your whole team, that's pretty sweet. Yeah. I mean, if you don't get another activation, it's not that horrible.
Yeah, I mean, it was the elves deck is missing. Really, it's missing a 3-drop Lord that we want to play, and this is probably the best version of that Lord we're going to see.
Yeah, because, I mean, on one hand, it's not a creature, so you're not getting additional damage, but on the other hand, it doesn't die to board wipes, it doesn't die to creature removal, so, I mean, there's definitely some scenarios where it's even better than if it were attached to a body, so that'll be interesting to see. I mean, plus, considering, like, elves decks can crank it out on turn two pretty easily, that's pretty awesome. But yeah, I think Nissa, it's going to be cool to see where this card kind of fits into decks and into builds. I know people are talking about Abzan running it. There's a lot of cards right now in Standard that get benefits from having counters on them. I know Alex was talking about that some. Are you excited for this card, Alex?
I think it's all right. I'm more excited about Inbringer myself.
Nice. Well, let's talk Inbringer, man. You got the text up on it?
I do. Cool. So it's 5 and a colorless, the new diamond colorless for a 5/5. It untaps on each other player's untap step. So already just insane on that.
Okay, nice, yeah.
So Vigilance without Vigilance, but has extra abilities for tap. So it taps, deals 1 damage to target creature or player. Pay a diamond and tap it. Target creature can't attack or block, or 2 diamonds and tap it and draw a card.
So that's a bunch of utility on a card that untaps on each player's turn. So, I mean, that's... obviously, I'm in love with the draw card ability. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I think this is one of those that R&D was looking at, and they're like, oh, we want to add this color, but since it's going to be restrictive, we can get away with throwing more power on a card because you're restricted into these. And this is the prime example of that.
That's a good point, yeah. But, I mean, it also has that feeling of a card that was powerful, but they felt it needed something more, so they slapped one more line of text on it and maybe right. got a little carried away.
I think I'm sold on tap, draw card.
Like I said.
That was enough for it.
Yep, beautiful. And then untaps on each player's turn. Ugh. Yeah, no, I mean, that's, like I said, that's a lot of utility on one card. And I mean,
and it's a 5/5 beater, too, so you can just attack for 5, untap, then draw a card. Like,
leave it up for blocking. Like, yeah. Yeah, no, that's pretty, and the cost is 5 and a colorless, so 6 yeah. total.
Does it untap on your turn?
Each player is the exact wording.
Okay. I just had to ask that.
Well, I think they worded that way for Commander, so it untaps 4 times in Commander.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, they really are. They're giving a lot of love to the Commander players this set.
That's how the Eldrazi have always been, just Commander love.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I mean, no, the card sounds great. I'm definitely excited. Like, for this set, I'm just dying to see the commons and uncommons, man, really. I mean, because right now, like, you can see these cards slotting into pre-existing decks, but we won't really see if we can branch out to new stuff till we get, you know, the real bulk of the set. So that'll be cool.
Yeah, no, I'm excited because there wasn't a lot of uncommon bulk added from any of the other sets. We're still playing with cons, uncommons, if anything, you know? Nothing else has added anything.
Yeah, I mean, you look back at, like, Abzan Charm, the whole Charm cycle. I mean, there is a bunch of powerful commons and uncommons from those sets. And yeah, like you said, I mean, I think once we hit rotation again and clear some of those out, maybe we'll see some of these come in. But like, I want some that just come in out of pure power level. Like, I just want to see good cards come in.
Right.
And that's really where you get the ground foundation for new decks and to change standard up. So hopefully we'll get some good stuff out of that. So there's still some excitement left for the spoilers.
There's definitely one more card I would like to talk about.
All right, what you got?
This one's more for Eternal formats, if you can believe this one. Kalidus, Trader of Ghent. 2 colorless, 2 black for a 3/4 lifelinker. If a non-token creature an opponent controls would die, instead exile it and put a 2/2 black zombie onto the battlefield. Tap 2 in a black, sacrifice another vampire or zombie, put 2+1/+1 counters on Kalidus, Trader of Ghent. This card, I look at it, and... it fits really well into the Jund shell as another way, instead of going big with Olivia, you can go wide with Kalidus.
Yeah, it makes sense.
You're already in a deck that's on the kill everything plan.
Right.
So Kalidus is just extra value on killing everything. And, you know, they come out and bring out a sweeper and you have the mana available. Just eat those tokens up and make your Kalidus big.
And also exile is relevant too with things like Skooze running around, Culligan's Command, things like that.
Yep. I just wanted to point it out. I don't know if it's going to be the 4-drop that Jund wants. Jund already has 2 very solid 4-drops that it likes. 3 if you want to include Hangerback Walker into the conversation. But I really do like this card in that deck, and I think it warrants testing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point, because, yeah, that, I mean, like you said, it fits right into the game plan. It's on color. I mean, it's got most things they want. So what was the body on it?
It's a 3/4 lifelinker for 4.
3/4. Very relevant.
Which is,
there you go.
Which is already bigger than Olivia when it comes out, and it's immune to Bolt, which is something Huntmaster isn't until it flips.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, it's got all the makings there, so that's a good find, Jerry. That'll be interesting to see how that turns out. Alex, did you have any more of the spoilers you wanted to talk about?
We could do Kozilek's Return, just because it's also going to be C play in Modern.
Absolutely.
Yep. Read it off.
All right, so it's 2 and a red. It's Devoid. Deals 2 damage to each creature. Then it has, whenever an Eldrazi spell is cast for 7 or greater, you flash it back and deals 5 damage to everything. That's not the part that's relevant. The part that's relevant is the 2 damage at Devoid. So it gets Core Firewalkers, Ariok Champions, Forge Tenders...
Yeah,
just what we needed. Killing pro red things with red cards.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, what decks do you think are going to be running this bad boy?
Green red Tron.
Just green red Tron?
I mean, they already run Pyroclasm, and that's just better for getting the pro red stuff out of the way too. And instant speed, which is can be relevant.
Yeah.
There's a weird chance that Burn could play this out of its sideboard.
That's where my mind was kind of going.
If it needs it, like it ends up pulling Eidolons for this card, which isn't too much of a stretch. It's just the 3 mana cost is inhibitive to that deck.
Yeah, I mean, in a Burn heavy meta, I could kind of see it. In certain metas, I could see it. I think that's going to be a call, because it's definitely not an automatic slot in, because they don't hit 3 quite too often, but definitely considerable. I mean,
people are really hating out Burn right now. It kind of is the top dog with the 16 creatures, a slew of burn spells, and a Tarka's Command. That's become the paltry standard, one of the big tier one decks right now. And they need something to protect themselves from all the Firewalkers and the champions that were mentioned.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's why Burn went to Wild Nacatl as well, so they can push through Nacatl through all the per-red creatures.
Yep, it was the same concept with the Abzan lists that hit the Invitational that were winning, were running Snapping Gnarled so they could dodge Surge of Righteousness.
Right.
Nice, yeah. Well, I mean, so I know that there's a lot of spoilers available right to us right now, so were there any others you guys wanted to cover?
I want to talk about how bad Chandra Flamecaller is.
let's end on the bad note. So do we have any more that we like that we want to talk about before we go into this hate session?
Goblin Dark Dweller is really good, in my opinion.
Yeah, you got the text up on it.
Yep, 3/2 red for a 4/4 with menace. It's a goblin, sometimes relevant, sometimes not. Whenever it enters the battlefield, you may cast target instant or sorcery card with converted mana cost 3 or less from your graveyard if you would exile instead. So, already this is just really good with things like Culligan's Command, Crackling Doom.
Right.
And those are just in red, not even counting like
splashing.
The utility on this is insane.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's another, just tons of options with that card. I mean, anytime you're messing around with stuff in the graveyard, like, the potential is there for sure.
Now, was that a 3-mana instant or sorcery or 3-mana spell?
Instant or sorcery.
Instant or sorcery, okay. So, the one thing that kept in check was if it had said 3-mana spell, this card would slot over Siege Gang Commander in Legacy Goblins. So I think they put that on there purposely.
Yeah.
I mean, you can still flashback Whirling Outburst.
Oh, yeah. Very true. That's pretty good.
What was the trigger for flashing something back?
Just enters the battlefield.
When it enters, okay. Yeah, nah, definitely a pretty sweet card. We'll have to keep an eye on that. I mean, that could definitely be a standard playable.
Yeah.
All right, so now on to Jerry's topic here.
All right. This card is... It's not even better than the original 6-drop Chandra. At least the original 6-drop Chandra could affect the board state, and
on minus X.
On minus X, sure. But it's not even what I think it was intended to be. I'm pretty sure during the design at one point, minus X was supposed to be -4 Wildfire. Because Wildfire was the 6-mana spell that dealt 4 damage to all creatures and all players, and all players sacrificed 4 lands. I'm pretty sure that's what this was at one point. And they realized, maybe I don't want to be making standard players sacrifice 4 lands. So they pulled that off of it. I know, I love it too. But this is not Wildfire. The 0 ability is... you're not going to play this in your mono-red burn deck. You're just not. You don't play 6-drops in that list. You're not going to be playing this in a Tarka red. By the time you cast this to try and win the game, you should already be winning the game. Like that, you shouldn't be casting 6-drop Planeswalkers to make that happen.
Well, read off the abilities real quick before we get too far.
All right. So 2 red, 4 colorless for a Planeswalker Chandra type. +1... Put 2/3/1 red elemental creature tokens with haste onto the battlefield. Exile them at the beginning and the next end step. 0. Discard all cards in your hand. Then draw that many cards +1. Minus X. Chandra Flamecaller deals X damage to each creature. The +1 also bothers me because the tokens don't even have trample. Like, they're supposed to be Hellspark Elementals and Spark Elementals, but they don't have the trample effect. Like, you're playing a 6-mana Planeswalker. I would expect at least that. They don't sit around on the battlefield for them to protect her. They just exile. At least Chandra Blaze, the original 6-drop, had the +1, discard a card, you get to Flame Javelin a creature or a player. Like, that affected the board state in at least a semi-decent way. I mean, she saw play in a very old Cruel Ultimatum control list where you were discarding the Cruel Ultimatums just to activate her ultimate to cast all the Cruel Ultimatums, which was a solid game plan as a one of in your deck. But that's all it ever saw play in. I don't see a home for this Chandra anywhere. It's very difficult for me to say. The 0 is where all the power might lie, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I was going to say that. I think the only shell this has for a couple months is Sphinx's Tutelage.
Ooh, yeah, that's not a bad point.
Sure, yeah. That's actually pretty sweet there.
Yeah, I think that's the only place it'll lie. And like you could just combo kill somebody if you curve, you know, Tutelage into another Tutelage into All Merits Archive into Chandra. I think you just win.
Yeah, that would pretty much win you a game right
there.
You'd
draw double the cards and then just mill them out.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But this isn't where I want my red Planeswalker to be. Like, honestly,
no, I agree.
Honestly, at 6 mana, Chandra could have said +2, shock target creature or player, and that would have been good enough. I mean, this was the original Sorin. That's what he did at 6 mana. So why can't a red Planeswalker do this?
Yeah, I definitely think, like, I think it's interesting that we got a 3-drop green Planeswalker in a color that typically ramps, and then we get a 6-drop red Planeswalker. I mean, it just... right off the bat, seeing her convert a mana cost kind of threw me through the loop, because that just... Yeah, like you said, I mean, it doesn't make any sense in the color. It's going to be very hard-pressed to see her see play. Now, I had not thought of Tutelage. I'll completely admit that.
Yeah, I'll
admit
that.
That actually sounds kind of sweet. But, you know, there's a limited amount of time left on that clock. I mean... I always kind of hate it when you get these Planeswalker cards where the plus ability is very aggressive. I mean, you're sending creatures at them. There's no protection. There's no sticking around. None of that. And then the minus ability, like you said, Jerry, in a red deck, like you want to be winning already at that point if you're trying to go fast. And then if you're not, she's probably the last card you have in hand at that point. I mean, maybe you've like sandbagged some lands because you knew you're going to play her, but you're probably not getting many cards off of that ability. I mean, obviously Tutelage is a different beast there. It's hilarious there, but for the most part, it doesn't... Drawing cards to me feels like a very mid-rangey, control-ish kind of strategy, whereas getting in with these 3-1s does not fit that profile at all. I mean, I guess if you're aggressively killing all of their things, she might be a decent win con because you're slinging 6 at the face, essentially, but the caveat to that is they can't have anything on the battlefield.
It's the absolute worst way to sling 6 at someone's face. Like, they don't even have trample.
2 Nissa tokens, stop it.
Yes, that's a huge point. 2 Nissa tokens, and if for some reason they're 1/2s, they just stop it right then and there.
Yeah.
And then you get the Chandra back with
your
cards.
Yeah, they just chump and just, boom, you're done. Even as 0/1s, chump, eat the damage, done. Yeah, so, I mean, we'll see, obviously. I mean, there's always that asterisk next to any spoiler. Who knows what the rest of this set's going to bring, but I don't see this one being too hot.
No.
No pun intended there. All right. So we've got a little bit of time left. Well, actually, no, I take that back. We're running over on this. So we had some more news items, but I guess we will be earmarking those for another day. Before we get out of this, though, I do want to say farewell to Patrick Sullivan. I mean, anyone who's seen the announcement, he picked up a position at Activision, so he will be leaving Star City Game coverage in 2016. And, I mean, he's been doing it for years. He's... one of those commentators that I never loved, but now that he's going, I'm definitely going to miss. Him and Cedric had some great chemistry for all the Star City Games events, so I mean, that's going to be interesting to see what they do. Matthias Hunt's pretty good, but I don't know if he's up to being the new Patrick Sullivan, you know?
Nah, who knows? Give him the chance, I say. Let him sink or swim. I think he'll do fine.
But all right, but yeah, so that's going to do it for this first segment. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about Going Rogue. All right, so you have joined us in the middle of the podcast, and we are going to pick some names here. We got Rob's bingo ball fired up, ready to go. I can't believe I'm actually using this, and he's not here to make me, but I'm doing it by choice. So we're going to call off, we're going to pull 4 names here out of this. Before we do it, thanks tons for everybody who took the time out to leave those comments. It was awesome. Also, before we get into this too, wanted to give a shout out for Alex. We had a listener submit a deck that he was working on, and Alex, I mean, knocked it out of the park, gave the guy tons of suggestions and stuff. So please, guys, like, utilize that as much as you want. Any format, any type of deck, just reach out. You can email us through the website. You can even shoot us a message on Facebook. Alex loves doing that type of stuff. He has a blast, so definitely utilize that. But, all right, the time is now. Fire up this really annoying machine here.
Just make out that crank noise.
Here
go,
we go,
go, go, go.
2, 3, 4. All right. So let's see what we got here. B10, which is Mark West. All right, so Mark West is number one here.
Hey, Mr. West, if you can you tell me if you do any transformations with your watch there, Ben 10?
Horrible joke, but
gosh, darn it, Jacob.
But we love him, so he gets to stay. All right, we got I-17.
Yeah, I've got nothing for I-17. Oh,
man, this is a tough last name. Tristan. Man, I don't even want to say
anything. Let me try it. I want to try it. All right. Let
Jerry try, because that's the good option.
Wait, I'm going to spell it out for you. It's B-O-U-W-H-U-I-S.
What you got, Jerry? I want to hear it.
He's writing it down. He's thinking over here.
B-O-U-W-H-U-I-S. I will take a shot in the dark and say your last name is pronounced Beauvoir.
Ooh, that's pretty solid, actually.
Yeah, that's not bad. It sounds good if it's not right, so that's good. I don't even want to say what was going on in my brain. I have no idea. All right, so next we got B6. Brooks Dorsey. Congratulations. You are number three on here, so let's mark that down. And our fourth and final winner, B5, which is Austin Archer. Oh, man, dude. All right, he won last time, but we're going to leave it anyway. Congrats, yep. Austin.
Dude, pick my lottery numbers.
For, you know, comment and enter and stuff. You can win twice.
Yeah, look at that, Austin. The bingo ball loves you. The bingo ball. What? I don't even know what this thing is called,
it's,
man.
It's the bingo roller. You roll the balls and the balls come out, man.
Man, like, I love and hate this little thing. But all right, so those are our four winners. This will go up Wednesday. Like, I lost a week somewhere in the month. I totally intended to have these out and announced, I guess, last week. Dude, I don't know what I was thinking. I've been crazy busy. But give us your address information. You can email it to us through the website. You can message it to us on Facebook. That's probably the easiest way for us to keep track of it. And we'll get these shipped out for you. Obviously, you don't know what you've won yet. We're keeping it in the spirit of Christmas.
Secret Santa.
Yeah, we've got some cool stuff. The one thing I will say that you're all getting is we've come up with, we need to post a picture on the Facebook or something, but we've got life pads, I guess, yeah, is all you would call it. The official Snapcast ones with the logo and everything, they look pretty sharp. So we'll be sending out some of those to each of you, but you'll also get some stuff. Like, I know, I don't want to say anything on
don't
there,
spoil
but there's
it. No
yeah,
spoilers.
Yeah, no spoilers.
Star Wars style, no spoilers.
Man. There's some cool stuff, though. So when you receive stuff, man, please send pictures on the page. Let people know that we're not sending out, like, you know, bottle caps or anything like that. Some good prizes. But all right, guys, we will be back with the second portion of the show in just a second. Thanks for listening. All right, welcome back, everybody. So for this segment, we wanted to cover something that is near and dear to Alex's heart, and that is going rogue. And it's actually, you know what? Let me let the man himself tell you. Alex, tell us about this concept.
So we all know I love to brew and play things that I like to play to either, you know, success or not. Oh, it's yet to be determined. but for the most part, I think there's a time and a place to play a deck that's not expected. And I know Jerry is also with me on brewing and playing, you know, fringe decks. But I kind of wanted to talk about it because, especially like for newer players and people that play, you know, so for a while there, it was really bad about people, oh, you're net decking and you should play your own thing. And that was like a big argument, which I think we've talked about that already, haven't we?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. So like net decking we've covered, we know it's fine. But, you know, when's the time that you want to play your own thing? When do you want to, you know, attack the meta, as I like to call it? And one of the biggest things, I think, smaller tournaments is just the way to attack it. If you know people are going to be playing certain decks, you can just be like, oh, I'm playing this because it beats all them.
Now, before we get too deep in this, I know we've told this story a few times. I don't know how much detail we've gone into, but I actually met you while you were playing a rogue deck at the Classic, and you beat my face in.
I was gunning for mono black that weekend, so I was running Witch Stalkers and Blood Barons in the main.
Yep. So, I mean, not to go too back into that matchup, but I mean, it was just tons of stuff that Mono Black had a very hard time dealing with. And of course, he found me at the tournament and I was playing Mono Black. And I know I put up a very long and strenuous fight, but I just could not. He forced me into the darkness. And I think that was, and that's what I think when we're talking about this subject, we need to remember, like, there are a lot of new players who like to go rogue right out the bat, and that's kind of their thing. And like Alex was saying, like, there's a time and a place, because you really, it's funny because newer players tend to want to go rogue, but really you need to be on the top of your game to go rogue. I mean, you need to know what you're gunning for, why you're doing it. It can't just be this like willy-nilly, I really like this strategy. Well, is anything weak to it? Are you going into a slaughter by playing this deck? I mean, it needs to really angle shoot specific decks or specific things going into the meta.
Exactly.
Yes. The one thing that really catches with being able to play a rogue deck is you need to be familiar with the entirety of the format, especially once you get into Eternal formats where you have 20 to 30 decks you could play against. You really need to know what your matchup is against everything in order to be successful.
Yeah, and a lot of it comes from knowing your deck, and that's why I think it's better for Eternal formats. Like, there's never any brewing or innovation, it seems like, in like Legacy, sure, but in Modern there's a lot, because you can, like, even though there's a lot of decks and the format's diverse, you know what the big ones are. You know you want a gun for like Twin and Affinity and things like that, so you can try to be like, oh well, this beats these, so then you start testing the other matchups and you know your deck better than your opponent, and that helps out a lot too.
Like, there was one rogue deck at Modern Classic that really threw me through a loop, and I was watching this guy play it, and he clearly knew his matchups. It was a red-white prison list where he was using Spirit Guides to jam in turn one chalices for one. He was playing Ghostly Prisons with Ghost Quarters on top of Leona and Arbiter and Blood Moons all in the main board. So it was a real rogue deck, and if I'm not mistaken, he did top 16 that tournament. I know he didn't top 8, but you could probably find his list.
That's
and
so beautiful.
Yeah, he did a deck tech at the Invitational, actually, for that list. It was Ryan Hip.
That was it?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Like, I realized when I saw this guy playing this deck, I'm like, if I play this guy, I'm going to lose. I don't think I can beat this unless I just have the hand.
Ghostly Prison and Blood Moon in the same deck are completely hilarious. I like that a lot.
Yeah, no, it really. I saw the deck lit tech for it, and it's a pretty solid list. It's just, I think he was also running Paths, and Paths in a Blood Moon is just such a non-bow. I guess Leon Arbiter can help out a lot, but like, I just hate playing Path and Blood Moon in the same deck.
But when you have Path plus Leon and Arbiter, it doesn't really matter.
Right, but nonetheless.
Nonetheless, you are right. It is a non-bow. But yeah. The list was rogue to the point where most people really couldn't deal with it. It was really the deck beating itself at that point.
Well, that's a great example of rogue too, where if you're hitting people with surprise Ghostly Prisons or surprise Blood Moons, like, you get some free wins out of that. Bam, I win.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the type of thing you want to be going for when you're going rogue. A lot of times we see players who put together these Modern decks that it might win on turn 7 if it draws the right thing, and that's just not feasible.
Like, no, that's not the way you want to go about rogue. You still want to maintain the pace of the format
exactly.
At the same time.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned it earlier with, like, it needs to have good matchups against other decks, and that's the key thing. Like, it needs to respect the boundaries of the format, whichever format you're in. It needs to be realistic. It can't just be this pet deck that is never going to win unless if, like, your opponent draws all lands or something crazy like that.
And there is a distinction, too, between rogue and pet deck.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And pet cards, too. Like, those are, sometimes it's fine to run like a pet card or two, but you got to understand when it's bad.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we've all played against the sort of pet deck that gets lucky and just has one absurdly good matchup, and then all of its other matchups are garbage. Like, it just whoops you. I mean, like, something like, I played against Mill as Scapeshift at one point. He hit a bunch of mountains pretty early. I'm like, well, like,
there goes your game plan.
Yeah, like, you look invincible right now. But then you go next round and play Twin and just get turned forward every single game and have no fight against it. So, but yeah, I mean, let's talk about more about the pros of it. I mean, do you have any specific instances lately, Alex, where you've been going rogue?
I've been messing around a little bit in Modern and catching some people. I've been playing on, you know, Cockatrice and things like that, where I'm playing a green-red deck that's sole purpose is to turn 2 Blood Moon.
Nice.
It's just okay. Dorks, Blood Moons, and Magus of the Moon. And you catch so many people, like, because I fetch turn 1, try to fetch a Stomping Ground to throw them off already. So, like, oh, I'm safe to get my Shockland 2, and then you're just like, oh, here's turn 2 Blood Moon. Like, have fun.
It's funny you mentioned that, Alex, because I'm doing a blue-red deck that does the same thing, but I'm on blue-red Scred control.
Sure, sure. Or Blue Moon or Scred, yeah, any of those.
Yep. Just something.
I've played maybe that deck too.
nobody's playing Screds right now. The card's really good, and I really wanted to jump on that and try to push through a list with unique things. I was top ending at Thundermaw Hellkite, which is just falling out of favor in the format. People are picking up on Jeskai Twin again, so you get to beat Resto Angels with this card. So
yeah.
a lot of being fringe and rogue doesn't necessarily mean that it was never played. It could just be something that's just old and hasn't been touched in a while, and you're bringing it back into the light.
And that's part of it too. I think it's the biggest pro to going rogue is, especially in modern, where it's a format where knowing your deck is better. You know your deck. You know what your end game is. You know what your plan is going into every match. Okay, it's this matchup. I need to do this. Well, meanwhile, your opponent's trying to figure it out. They're like, oh, crap, what is this guy doing? How do I stop it? Right. Did I already mess up? And I think that's one of the biggest pros.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, being able to catch people, I mean, harking back to Scape Shift always cracks me up because players that started in the last 6 months or so may have never played against it, and matchups where my opponent doesn't know what I'm doing are essentially free wins. I mean, there's been lots of times where, they just play around things completely wrong. They're not sure how to deal with stuff. So when you think about going rogue, you have the opportunity to be like that almost every single match. So, I mean, that's definitely a huge bonus to it. I mean, modern, like you guys have both said, there's certain land drops that people hit turn one and two where your mind is already kind of buzzing. Like, what is this? What am I sitting across? Like,
turn one Steam Vents into Serum Vision sells about, you're either on twin or control.
Yeah, exactly.
Makes it pretty easy.
But then if you see like Overgrown Tomb, and no Hand Disruption, no Goyf, no, like your head starts to go, wait, what am I playing against right now? Like, this should be Abzan or it should be Jund, but I don't get what's happening right now. But yeah, so I mean, just being able to catch people off guard is a huge sell in it. I mean, I'll admittedly, like, I'm not the type of person to go rogue at all. I like a very tight, I don't mind people knowing what my list probably is as long as I'm tight with the list and I'm playing it well. But even just switching to this Bring to Light version, like, you catch people and it's an exhilarating feeling when they have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah. And then also with going rogue, you can attack from a different angle, like graveyard combo. Wasn't a thing forever in modern. And then me and Rob started messing around with red-black reanimator with Grizzlebrand and Emrakul. And Grizzlebrand came about. Because people realize nobody's attacking the graveyard right now.
Yeah, I mean, things like that. There wasn't enough reason to be playing too many Relic of Progenitus. I mean, you had Goyf, you have Snapcasters, you had a lot of these sort of fringe benefits, but there wasn't that one deck, I mean, other than Living End, I guess, but there weren't a lot of decks at the time, because even Living End was seeing sort of a downtick during that period, so there weren't a lot of decks where you just hosed them for using their graveyard. Now, relics are all over the place, so it gets a little bit dangerous and things kind of come in and out. But yeah, I mean, I remember even like Bloom Titan wasn't a big deck when Rob first started playing it. I mean, maybe we need to pay more attention to what Rob's doing, because it seems like a few times in a row now that he started playing a deck and then it shot off to, you know, new fame, I guess. But yeah, I mean, you even look at like Bloom Titan, where it was this deck that wasn't hugely popular. And I mean, there's tons of these. Lantern Control is a big one right now, where like it's popping around on forums. The idea is out there. But if you take it to a tournament, 50% of players didn't know what you were doing at that point in time. I mean, now, you know, the cover's blown. But
even then, some people still just don't know.
Yeah.
And like I said, that's another one when it comes down to knowing your deck. Like, if you know it good enough, like Jerry playing Ad Nauseam. I think instant speed combos is a big thing right now too, because people may not know it and not play around it.
Exactly. It happened in the Invitational for me. I caught one guy that just did not know what I was doing, and he read every single card word for word, and then he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, let me show you. Let me get a judge. Did my thing. Judge was like, yeah, that's how it works.
Yeah, there's a lot of interactions in Ad Nauseam that are very, like, they're head scratchers. They're a little unintuitive. They catch you, and it's not easy to put it together based on just the text alone of the cards. I mean, that's a great example, because you until you run through the motions, you don't quite get why all these things are happening. Like,
that deck made me do something for the first time at the Invitational I'd never done before. I had asked for an Oracle text on the same card 3 times for 3 different reasons in the same game. The card, The Rack, it can do damage to players, which was one of them. It doesn't target players, which was another interaction. And the order of the stack is chosen by the opponent, despite it being on my upkeep. So, you know, just all those little things get added together. And just knowing your own deck really helps when trying to figure out how to beat an opposing game plan.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame we didn't get into that story during the first segment, because, yeah, he was cracking me up before we started recording today. Because, I mean, that's just, like, most players aren't going to have that initiative to call, get the Oracle text, to run every possibility through their mind while they're playing. So you're going to catch a lot of people. And, I mean, he's talking about playing against 8-rack. That's a fringe deck. Like,
true statement.
Yeah, if someone goes turn one Shrieking Affliction, there are some people that just don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Now,
so,
lucky enough, I figured it out right away. Turn one, Rack. All right, we're on.
Yeah. Yeah, we know what's going on here. Turn one, you know. That deck can be deceptive, too, if they start with that turn one Inquisition or Thoughtseize. You're like, oh, it's probably just, you know, Abzan on a basic swamp or something.
Abzan, Jund, or even Twin. Yeah.
Tokens.
Like, you could be anything.
Yeah. Tokens. Good to you there.
Yeah, it's a very masked play there. So, yeah, I mean, that's just, like, I think we've harked on it enough. I hope they get the point, but the power of confusion is very strong in Modern. I mean, it's a format where you can punish someone so quickly for mistakes that it's among the best. I mean, Legacy's up there too, but it's a little more tricky to catch people. But either of these formats, you catch people and confuse them for one turn, two turns, you may have already won the game. Like, that's all it takes. Yeah. I definitely think Standard is probably, I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I really don't like going Rogue and Standard. I think the card pool and the amount of cards available, you're typically already playing the best cards.
Yeah, the card pool's too small. A lot of the best cards have already translated as being the best cards in Modern. So you need to come up with a really valid reason as to why I'm not playing either Siege Rhino or Jace Vryn's Prodigy. Like, there better be something that I'm missing completely.
I'll throw Gideon in there too. Like, you better
Ugin as well. My mistake. I did forget about him. But at the same time, I better be playing one of these three cards. It is, you know, there's got to be some good reason that I'm not on it. Monastery Swift Spear would be another one for Atarka Red and Atarka's Command. Like, both of those cards are translated into Modern, so I think I should be playing these in Standard as well.
Yeah, I think
it just comes down to Standard. You're just going to play the best cards. It's a small pool. You're going to play the best cards. That's what makes your deck. There's not really, there's not too many angle shooting in Standard.
I will say the Tutelage decks, there was a little bit of that for a while with the Tutelage decks, but that's a very, I think that might be what you're looking for in Standard. If you want to go Rogue in Standard, you need a really good build around card. Now, the unfortunate part to that is you also need all of the other tools. And I think Tutelage,
you need the support cards.
Yeah, just barely had the cards. I mean, if it had one, two better support cards, it would have been a huge tier one threat for a long time.
Like, Tutelage was one of those Standard decks where it was rogue enough and it was good enough because it was in a point in time where we were at the biggest possible point Standard could be at that time, with the biggest card pull. And then the card pool immediately shrank 3 months later. Mono Red and then the Blue Red Artifact deck that really ran rampant for that 3 to 4 month period, you know, that was part of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, those are good examples of decks where you needed a good supporting cast. I mean, you look at Standard decks right now, and it's, like you guys were saying, it's just the best cards thrown together. You pick three or four colors, you put the best cards together. It's classic mid-range format now where you're playing the best stuff. So going rogue is very tricky in those situations, and I think, yeah, the build around's probably the best bet, but you just have to have those tools. And I mean, we've all played against a Standard deck where they've taken a build around card and done it despite not having the card pool, and it's fragile, it's inconsistent, it doesn't work half the time. I mean, it's just a big mess, and you can't take that to a tournament and expect anything good to come of it. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I agree with that. And then also, we also have to look at the cons of going rogues here. Like, it's not perfect. Like, there's definitely times that it's bad. And like, one of the biggest things here is you don't have the testing time in it, usually. Like, nobody else is playing the deck. You can't look to somebody else for advice and see what this guy's doing. Like, you're all on your own.
That's exactly. You have to play it twice as long as, say, an already tested deck just to understand your matchups the way a tested deck would be. So you have to devote more time to it.
You have no sideboard to work with, no sideboard guides. You've got to build your sideboard from the ground up. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely a lot of work. I think the benefits of it are worth it, but I also think there's a lot of times where, like, you need to know when to abandon this deck also, because There are a lot of times where it's going to look great on paper. It's going to look great for the first half of testing, and then all of a sudden, it just you find three or four matchups that is just horrible against, and it's just time to put it back to sleep. I mean, looking at new cards that are coming out in standard is a great way, because we see it a lot happen where older decks that had fallen out of favor see a resurgence because something was printed that give them another leg up. I mean, right. Even like the unbanning of Bitter Blossom has been interesting, because you see like Fairies has been popping up some, Black-White Tokens is popping up some, yeah. But they both still just kind of need something.
Yeah, they're almost there.
Yeah, like, very close.
They're definitely like short a card or two to just find what they need to be a solid deck.
Yeah, I mean, Fairies, Black-White Tokens, they're probably both just shy of one card. One could do it, could put it up there, you know, among the better decks in Modern. But the biggest thing, though, is just knowing when to put the deck down. I mean, both of those I still think you can have a lot of success with. I mean, I'm finishing up Black-White Tokens now. I definitely plan on running it at a few events here and there. But you need to be coming from the right place. You either need to have found some fringe strategy that is so powerful that you're going to be able to just get people, or something that has such a good matchup against a certain percent of the meta that you have a good chance of rolling the dice and just shooting your way through the whole thing if you get the right matchups. Or the third option is something that you're just having a lot of fun playing with and you're okay picking up a few losses. Obviously, you can't do this weekend after weekend, but I think we've all done it at some point where we've taken something to a smaller tournament just to kind of have fun with it and see how it goes.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's one of the other things too, is like, because it's so time intensive to test a brew on your own and stuff like that, you might not know about a bad matchup.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
like you might sit down at a tournament and be like, bad. Oh, I'm angle shooting Twin, and you play some, you know, you play Junk for the first time because you were testing against Jund and just get destroyed.
Yeah, like you need to be able to catch all your matchups, and sometimes it's just not an option.
Yeah, sometimes right, you find out Path to Exile just hoses your deck. You just didn't test against certain white decks. I mean, Path is one of those weird cards where, like, if you're testing against Splinter Twin and Jund and, you know, I mean, there's a good list you can come up, Affinity. There's a bunch of decks you can test against where Path just never comes up. And then you go play a tournament and you play Black-White Tokens into Abzan and you just, like, get hosed.
And all these pads come out of nowhere.
Yeah, all of a sudden, oh, yeah, that's right. That's a huge card in this format. But, you know, I mean, like I said, you could test against 5-6 decks, maybe even 7, and just never see a Path.
Oh, it also comes down to variations, too. You could have tested against Blue-Red Twin, American Twin the whole time, but then you find out Grixis Twin, because, you know, Culligan's Command randomly beats you or something like that, you know?
Yeah, or even vice versa, where you've been testing against Grixis and they have a lot of dead cards, then Blue-Red 10 hoses you. I mean, yeah, it's just Modern such a big format that I think the process of building a rogue deck and tuning a rogue deck is probably 6 months to a year to get a solid 75.
Yeah, that's about right.
I mean, so you got to know that you're in it for the long run. I mean, I was playing an Enchantress list that Alex and Jerry brewed up that was going Bant to use neither Reliquary and the new Retreat to Coralheim. And I mean, the deck was sweet. I just found out I didn't have the wherewithal to stick with it and keep testing it. I mean, it gets brutal at times because you go to some tournaments and it feels like the best pile of cards you've ever played. And then you go to another and it just feels like, what does it need? I mean, and even over the course of a month or so, we had switched out some sideboard cards, switched around cards, and just slowly fine-tuned. And I mean, that's the process that it takes. It's got to be a labor of love because you're not going to get quick rewards for this at all.
Yeah. And it comes down to even just finding the right number of cards. Is 4 too many? Is 3 not enough? You know, things like that, too, that it takes several, you know, matches to figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between 3 and 4 can be huge sometimes, and that's what you find out over these months of testing. I mean, we've harped on it tons, but just the matchups are so infinite, essentially, in Modern, with everyone's variation on popular decks, and even sometimes the weird budget things you run into at tournaments where they've switched a card for that purpose, you can get hosed by it. But overall, though, I think it's a process that every Magic player should try at some point. I think it's something that it's a certain part of the Magic game that if you don't do it, you just never really develop that ability. And there's things where it's going to help you see metas better. I mean, it's going to help you understand metas, understand matchups. It's going to bring up those skills in other areas that you probably lack them in if you've never done this. And I think it's also like I mean, we've talked about it before, but you go through this weird period as a Magic player where as you come into the game, you tend to hate net decking and you love these creative new builds that people are coming up with. Then you get a lot better and you're into net decking and you hate all these rogue decks that randomly knock you out of a tournament because no one else is playing them. You didn't game plan for them. And then at the end of the day, you kind of settle into this spot where you understand that the majority of decks are going to be net decks and variations of those, but you have this kind of weird respect for the rogue deck. I mean, it takes something serious to go in and start looking at the huge catalog of cards and start putting something fresh together. And all of these decks were rogue decks at one point.
Yep.
I mean, some came together more obviously than others, but like looking at things like Bloom Titan, like you had to go pretty deep to really start putting that deck together to see its full potential.
Yeah, and that's what something I want to say too is just don't be afraid to brew. Like, yeah, we had a bunch of cons there we talked about where it seemed like, oh, you should never do this, it's just bad, you'll never win. But like, all decks start somewhere. Like, somebody has to put card A with card Z together to figure it out. It could be you, who knows, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, in Modern, like, you may be rewarded for it in 2 or 3 years. You've got this great idea that you love. You always kind of tinker with it. It's always in your backpack in one of your random deck boxes. And then 2 years from now, they print some card that everyone else is just bashing. It's the worst card ever, but you realize that light goes off. That's going to fit perfectly into this shell. That's what it needed.
And it'll send it all the way to the top when you just spike a tournament.
Yep.
Hey, look at Temur Ascendancy and Temur Sabertooth. Temur Sabertooth was a card that was missing. That card got printed. Nobody was like, ah, this card's great. No. But then the one deck is like, oh, this is the card I needed.
Yeah. One guy saw it and said, perfect.
This is the card I need to go infinite. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Bingo. This was what it needed all along. I didn't know it, but it was just Temur Sabertooth. But yeah. That's, and especially Modern in a format where like, people aren't constantly going back and comparing all the new cards to all of the opportunities out there. There's probably something sitting out there right now that tons of people have missed because there's just so many cards in the format that it's very easy to miss interactions between random common from Khans of Tarkir plus random uncommon from, you know, whatever. So,
and that's one of the cons too, is just you can't know everything. So you could like, oh, these two cards work great together, but it's a little, you know, fragile. But there's this other card you didn't think about that actually works better that you just, oh, I should have just been running this the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Functional, almost the same card, but with indestructible or something along those lines. Yeah. I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
The card pull's huge. Now, I will say, like, MTG Gather does a good job where you can search by keywords, you can search by all kinds of different filters. So sometimes if you're looking for a specific piece, that's a way to go. But even with that tool, I mean, it's just a bunch of digging. So, I mean, it takes a lot of commitment. We're coming up on time here. Do you guys have any last thoughts on this before we get out of this?
No, that about wraps it up.
Like I said, I think it's just don't be afraid to do it.
Yep. So, I mean, take the time, build the rogue deck, enjoy it, have fun with it. Before we go, we got a few announcements. Holiday giveaway went great. Thanks for that. Tons of support from people, tons of people feeding in. It's awesome. I mean, we have a very hard time getting a feel for the types of people we're seeing, the types of people that are listening, because to be completely honest, our way of tracking downloads and things like that is rough. We know we're missing out on some segments where we're not tracking some numbers, and even then it's just numbers. So being able to put faces and names and people to who's out there listening right now is awesome. So that was a huge help. Glad for that. We'll definitely be doing something like that again in the future. Other than that, Rob's videos are coming out every Friday. We're looking to set up another day where we're going to have videos come out on a weekly basis. So definitely stay tuned for that. Probably going to be taking some downtime over the holidays. I think Rob will still probably have his video up, but as far as additional content outside of that, I'm not sure. Next week, you will see that we're going to be pre-recording just sort of a fun chit-chat session. So the episode that comes out next week right after Christmas is going to be much more laid back, much more chill. So we're going to do that so we can take a break off during the holidays and everything. But then we'll be back with some serious content after that. But all right, guys, thanks for listening.